This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time.
Okay, Catherine, where are we at this week?
Okay, at the moment, I'm trying to get my social media in order.
Excellent.
Not something I'm very good at. My tendency is to lurk.
The best of us have lurked.
Tex told me to pick one. So initially I tried to do Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Now
that
I've
is
cut
not one.
It back. Yeah, I know. So Facebook is my least favourite. I'm doing Twitter and Instagram. But in doing this, it occurs to me that I actually know someone who is very, very good at social media. Kate?
I would not call myself very, very good at social media.
But all right.
But I had to do what my publisher told me and various things.
I would like you to teach me everything you know. So how do you approach social media? What's your theory about why it's important? What works? What doesn't work?
So I was told the same thing. I was a lurker before the book came out, and but I found being especially on Twitter really, really useful. RMIT told us to do it to get part of the writing community, to understand what the prizes that were happening, the funding things that were happening, what publishers were putting out. And so as a network, I found it extraordinarily useful right from the start. Black Ink told me to do the same thing, choose one thing. But at the same point, kind of do various things. So, for instance, I was told that on Instagram for the month of release, I needed to do one picture a day. Now, one of those scenarios ended up being me in clothing from a store that I love that had given me some clothing to
Did
promote.
You?
Yeah.
What store?
Obis, which I love. But this was me with my neighbour in my chicken shed with me trying to look kind of Obisy, but also writerly.
That kind of gumboot.
Gumbooty writer with the young children and the chickens. Obis didn't use those pictures, quite rightly. And
so how did you set that up though?
I knew someone there for a little bit. I said I was going to wear things to certain things, which they gave me to. I think they did a giveaway on their Instagram.
Can we do this?
Oh my gosh, who do you want? Who do you want to do it? Not like it was a, I certainly wasn't approached by Obis because of my incredible
fashion
things.
No, but maybe for the podcast, we can see if we can get Obis.
Okay, if you are out there and you are an incredible Melbourne brand and you want to sponsor us to wear your clothes while we are recording this.
Or feeding chickens.
Or feeding chickens, we'll do it. So I don't know that it worked for me, but what I do think works is being a good writing community member.
Okay, so on this topic, I have actually audited both of our social media.
I cannot believe
processes.
You've done this. I did not know Catherine was doing this. This is new to me.
I think this points out some of the point that you're making. Oh, because there's also this widely held thing. The one thing Tex did say was 80% about other people, 20% about you.
Which I've totally heard as well, and then I talked about this with a social media specialist who is not necessarily in literature, and she was like, nah, that's not true.
Well, I do notice some very
established, popular.
Some popular, you know. Authors certainly don't follow the 80-20 rule. Right, but auditing yours. So Twitter, we have 825 followers, which is not insignificant. Now, but if I look at your last five tweets, okay, so you have one retweet without comment.
Yeah, safer that way, right?
One looking for help for a young author that you know.
Yep.
You had two comments complimenting people on events that you attended. So in the kind of style of, you know, this person just went to this event run by this with this person talking about this. So lots of nesting of, you know, referring to people, tagging people, all of those sorts of stuff. And one link to someone else's article with comment introducing it. All of these tweets were within the last 5 days. So
I feel like I'm in therapy.
Well, none of them are about you. So that's what I'm learning.
Yep.
Tagging is interesting to me because I think you use tagging very well. This is, and we have actually talked about this off air before.
Yeah.
Because I am sort of mystified that introverts think that social media is, because I would see myself as introverted, think of social media as a great space for introverts, because I still see that tagging idea. I feel like I'm going up to someone at a party and standing really close.
Yeah. And I think that you get better at that. So I totally felt like that at the start, would never tag anyone. And I would feel like I was talking about people rather than to them. Whereas now I feel much more confident to say, you know, I loved tag, you know, Carmen Maria Machado's work, even though I don't ever think that she would respond to me or necessarily have a conversation with me, but I feel much more confident now about tagging her so that she knows or her publisher knows. Like, it's often about tagging the publisher. Maybe the writer isn't going to retweet it, but maybe the publisher will. Or
so do you think you feel that way because you are more of someone than you used to be, or it just is?
No, not necessarily. I think that I came to understand how significant it was when other people did it for me.
Yeah.
And I also think there are extraordinary opportunities to be had by meeting other writers and doing things with other writers in a professional business building sense, maybe, you know, projects that potentially have financial outcomes or publicity outcomes, but also in a collaborating artistic kind of way. And that,
yeah,
that forming those connections, especially when writers mostly stay home in their own little rooms, is really, really significant. And one way you can do that is via Twitter. And I certainly find that useful. I've got off Facebook a lot, although in promotional mode, I think it is really important that some readers will contact you via Facebook. And I think there's an element to which I like to respond to people now. And I heard that from a very experienced writer who had been writing for a long time, who had the experience of handwriting letters back to people. And she said, oh yeah, I respond to everyone. And at that point I was still feeling really nervous about responding to people who contacted me directly. Not that I was overwhelmed by people doing that, but I went back over a year's worth of those contacts and responded to each of them because I suddenly realized what it had meant for them to reach out and contact me.
Yeah.
Even if they weren't expecting a response or asking for one. And so I went back and made sure I did that.
So do you now would you send yourself, you know, an author that you admire, would you send them an email or
I have sent a couple of private messages to people saying how much I've enjoyed their work, but that's only if it's in the context of something that's above and beyond, you know, that's more private than what I would do. Yeah. I would see the most useful thing for me to do is to do that publicly because that is a recommendation and, you know, people – and I know that people – you know, my friends who follow my Instagram and see what I read, that they will often go out and borrow those books from the library or buy them.
Yep. Also interesting, the other day we were on a writing retreat with a friend, and the friend and I were sort of talking about Twitter. And this friend said, oh, I feel like you just go on Twitter and everyone sort of, you know, I never know what to say and I just kind of yell. Sorry, for some reason I find this funny. I just, on Twitter, you just kind of go out and yell, I have a new hat. Whereas you were saying, no, you don't go on Twitter and yell, I have a new hat. You say, I like your hat to someone else.
Yeah. And I think that that's what's useful. And I don't know if that creates sales or creates new followers. I think you can anecdotally say yes, that, you know, more people follow you or people engage with you if you're having those conversations. And there's part of it which is strategic. And I think we'd be lying to ourselves if we said there wasn't part of it that's strategic, but there also is part of it that is genuinely, oh my gosh, you person who I vaguely met once in a green room, you've put out a new book and it's amazing and I love it and I'm going to tell you this way because a whole lot of other people who didn't know about your book might now know it.
A couple of questions that are just practical things. social media, obviously very time consuming. When do you do it? Do you schedule it?
I've now tried to put a time in at night when I do it. I think you need to be daily. Very smart. Yep, daily. Be very smart about when you put things out. And now I have understood that through trial and error. So it is better to have something that goes out on people's train ride on the way home, for instance, than at 12 o'clock in the middle of the day when no one sees it. That's particularly on things like Facebook. I don't know how all the algorithms work. It's a time suck for me too. When I'm in deep, intensive writing periods, I try and switch off. Get off it.
Do you have – so I saw something for Instagram which I was like, ah, that's great. That's going to revolutionize my experience. I'm just going to do that from now on. And it was around, okay, Monday you talk about a book, Tuesday you talk about a podcast, Wednesday you talk about this. Do you do anything like that?
No, except for the fact that this year I have recorded what I'm reading on Instagram, yep. Partly because – I actually have never had a formal system for recording it and I really want to know. And it's kept me in line with it. Like I have made sure that I record all my books and I feel kind of a little bit out there and proud about going, yeah, you know what? This is actually what I read. Like this whole random variety of it.
Do you have any shameful reads that you would not – like are you secretly reading Maeve Binchy or
– No, I'm not. But there's probably books that I've posted about that – people might go, oh, I wouldn't know would read that kind of book.
Yeah.
But so it's been an interesting process for me to do that as well.
Yeah. Thanks for your help.
No worries. Get more followers. Everyone, can you follow Catherine, please, so she knows a little bit more
I'd
what to do?
I also audited myself, 115.
115. Okay, that is just going to up. You know what's going to happen? As soon as the book comes out, that's just going to go straight up. Start tagging.
Do you want to see how many Holly has?
Go on. Go on.
I'll be quick. I'll just check. It's probably gone up by the time this episode comes
out. Also, there's gangs. Like there might be a couple of gangs you want to get on Twitter. There's some cool little gangs that I want to be invited into.
But even a gang is hard to crack.
It really is. Guys, you know, guys, let me be in your gang.
Lurking. Okay. 2,790.
2,000. All right. That's our aim. In this episode, we talk to writer Toni Jordan about how she went from molecular biologist to full-time writer, ideas on a plane, and how to stalk a publisher. Today, I have the very great pleasure of welcoming beloved Melbourne author Toni Jordan to The First Time.
Hello.
Welcome, Toni.
Hello, Kate.
Toni Jordan has published 4 novels to international awards and acclaim. Her first edition was published in 2008 and her latest, Our Tiny Useless Hearts, in 2016. Before her writing career kicked off, Toni worked as a molecular biologist and quality control chemist, among other gigs. Toni's writing has been published widely in newspapers and magazines, and she is a well-known writing teacher. I have actually lost count of the times I've seen you thanked Toni in acknowledgements as a mentor and tutor and a generous and generally delightful member of the writing community here in Melbourne. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to be here.
So to launch straight in, tell us, it's been 10 years since your first book came out. How did Edition go from being a idea in your head to a book on the shelf?
Well, I had never written anything in my younger years, and I still probably categorize myself as not a creative person. As you said, I was a scientist for a long time. I did straight sciences at school and I did a Bachelor of Science at university. And then I worked as a molecular biologist for a long time. And then I did a few other jobs and I was moved into a writing role with biotech companies and pharmaceutical companies, writing drug dossier reports and new chemical entity reports and all these things you do not want to read, Kate, I'll tell you.
I'm sure they'd still have the Toni Jordan
flair. They're fascinating. You won't find them in the library. But then, one day my husband came up with this brilliant idea and said, if you were to go and get some kind of qualification in writing, you could start your own technical writing business from home.
So very pragmatic decision.
Yeah, it was completely a business kind of decision. One of the things I like least in the world is leaving the house. I don't like getting dressed. I like sitting at my desk in, the tracky dack kind of arrangement with the dog.
You have found the perfect career.
I know. And it brings me joy every day. I have what I call the 30-second commute now, which is just
the dream.
Yep. I sold the car. Anyway, This was always my nature. So the idea of perhaps not having to go somewhere every day was extremely interesting to me. Yep. So I enrolled here at RMIT in the Diploma of Professional Writing. And with the intention of doing all those very sensible nonfiction editing,
professional writing.
Yeah, professional writing. Yep. And that's, I can still remember my interview to get in where I said, yes, I'm a scientist. This is what I want to do.
They would have loved you.
They did love me. They did love me. I betrayed them though and did not do that work. But once I got here, I was filling out the subject form. And again, my husband, who honestly thinks he's a genius now, a complete genius, he said, your favorite thing to do in your free time is to read novels. And I have always been a mental fiction reader. Why don't you do one of those creative subjects just for the fun of it? So on the side of the course guide that had poetry and screenwriting and all those kind of things that I knew nothing about, I just ticked that box, novel, and started this incredible adventure just to follow what I like to do.
So there was no seed in your head of this particular story that edition became?
I truly was unprepared for how the whole process of teaching someone a creative art works. I had no understanding, not the way I do now, that there is an artistic process, which in my view cannot be taught, and a craft process, which can be taught. To me, that's very clear now. At the time, I had no idea. I imagined that, you know, for the first few weeks, they would sit you down and teach you how to get ideas for novels. Like, I had no concept that they actually expected you to have already been working on something and to already be the kind of person who worked on things. So I came into that subject, not just the oldest one in the class, which I was, but also the least prepared. I had no project on the go. I had never even considered that.
Do you think that that helped in the end, that you hadn't had this burning desire to be the novelist with your novel on the shelf all of your life, that you were open to what was coming?
I think it really did, because there was not that kind of pressure. I met a lot of really talented, fantastic young people in that course who had hooked their whole identity upon the idea of being successful in this area, and it was their life goal. And that made the whole experience so fraught for them and pressured. Whereas I was more than happy to make as many millions of mistakes. I had less ego about the process than if it was, you know, my dearest dream. I could just enjoy myself.
So was there a point that you went, okay, this thing that I'm doing now, this subject, this little bit of writing might actually be a novel?
It was always fun from the beginning, but in not knowing what to do, I started doing the same thing that everybody does, which is the loosely camouflaged autobiographical story, which was...
Which we all do so well.
Pretty rubbish. But, you know, it was just, at that point, it was words on the page. It was the hours spent. It was the warm-up.
Yeah.
It's the, you know, what do they call those? This isn't my term, but I've seen people refer to those as throat clearing.
Yes.
You know, that kind of thing. And I distinctly remember the moment I got the idea for what would become the first novel. That moment is vivid in my mind.
Tell us.
Well, since you asked, I was still doing, even while studying, I was working, doing technical writing for companies that I knew already from having worked for a long time. I had a job in Malaysia, in KL, writing training manuals actually for pharmacy sales reps.
Oh, hot.
So I had been over there in the offices of the company there. They wanted a native English speaker with scientific experience and writing experience. So I'd been over there doing that. I was on the flight on the way back. I was sitting in my chair. It had been a really full-on trip. This is the crucial part. I had an aisle seat and I had my laptop in the overhead compartment. And I was sitting there thinking, you know, I'll just watch the movie. And then I had this idea for this woman who counted things. And it truly, you know, the beginning of what became Edition, my first novel, was very vivid in my head. And the paragraphs that I started with, they didn't make the final novel, but they nearly did. They were there up until very close to almost the end edit.
So you just started writing right there in your seat.
Yep.
Bang.
And I often think, what would have happened had I've been not traveling for business and not with my laptop, or I had a window seat and the two people next to me were asleep? Would I have just gone, oh, well, I'll just watch the movie? And would that idea have then gone?
Passed you by.
Yeah, but I didn't. I got up and I wrote the first 1,200 words, I think, there on the plane. And it had, you know, I had to go back into class and tell my teacher, the very talented Olga Lorenzo that I
deeply talented
was dumping the previous idea and taking up with this
because
idea.
Because it felt so vivid.
Yeah, it felt so vivid and it was a real thing. And she, of course, was concerned as I am now as a teacher when someone says that to me, am I just jumping ship because it was getting hard or boring, the other one? But it was truly, it had its own energy, this story.
And how long could you hold that energy? How long did it take to get down a first draft?
It was actually quicker than you might imagine. It only took me 2 years to do that first draft. And that was extremely part-time while I was studying and working. And even once I finished the course, so I started it. This is all crystal clear in my head, despite how long ago it is. I started Audition in September 2004.
Yep.
And I finished that course at the end of 2005. I hadn't finished the draft. I was working for myself the next year in 2006, which was my plan when I started the course. And because I was working for myself, I was a little bit more flexible with time. So I started doing this thing where I would work 12 hours on Mondays, Wednesdays and Fridays for my clients doing the work. Like, you've got to pay the mortgage.
You do this have is to the pay problem. The mortgage.
And if you didn't have to pay the mortgage, things would be easier. So I worked 12-hour days, Mondays, Wednesdays and Fridays, and I spent Tuesdays and Thursdays on the manuscript.
Okay, so another year of writing on the manuscript.
Yeah.
Then you've got this draft.
Yeah.
What do you do with it? Do you know that it's a thing?
I knew that it was a thing. I've really felt like it was something.
So what did you do with it at that point?
Luckily, my scientist training kicked in. I knew I would have to get a lot of rejections. I mean, that's something that is a lesson that is taught very clearly through the unpublished manuscript community. Like, when you're connected to people, whether it's through courses or through membership to Writers Victoria or however, just listening and opening your ears, it's clear that you're going to get a lot of rejections. So the advantages that I had, again, in that regard is that I was older than everybody else. I had quite honestly already been divorced twice, so there's really nothing anyone could say to me that was...
You knew the rejection game?
Yeah, I was... I was not precious about failure.
Yep.
I worked out who I thought would be the right publisher for me.
And who was that?
That was Text. And I did that in quite a forensic manner where I went to readings and bought copies of Bookseller and Publisher News and I read them. And
these are great tips, everyone listening.
And I went to my local bookstore at the time, the Fabulous Top Titles in Brighton, and got their old catalogues for each publisher, you know, sends out. Back then they didn't email them. They were hard copy kind of catalogues.
So did you research
on
where you would fit?
Yeah, and I tried to make a mud map in my head of publishers don't really do a very good job at differentiating their brand to readers. They know what they're about. Publishers and big publishing houses have a number of imprints, which really have to be considered as separate publishers for the purposes of this kind of discussion. They know very clearly what they're about. We do this kind of book. This is the kind of stuff we like. And not just that, but this is the kind of stuff we're good at. So in their head, it's very clear. I think they do a pretty poor job of communicating that to readers. But they don't need to do a good job of communicating that to readers.
Because the readers don't need
to know. The readers don't need to know.
Authors.
Yeah, that's right. So you could cover up the spine. Even people who read a lot like me, you could have covered up the spine and said, where does this book come from? And I would have had zero idea. So I tried to force myself into the mindset of someone for whom the publishing landscape made more sense. And then I tried to explain it all in terms of kind of this rough mud map of who did what, who was good at what. I tried to position things in a sort of a scale on my head of where they sat, commercial versus literary, how the voices worked, Australian versus not, subject matter, so that I had a rough idea of what people did in their head, in my head. I came up with the top three. And one of the reasons why I thought Text, it's no point in my view chasing someone in order to hopefully beg them to take you on. To me, the process is kind of like dating. Zero fun when you're doing the chasing, maximum fun when you're being chased.
Maximum.
So it really mattered a lot to me that I could find someone who I thought would logically be interested in me rather than just my dream publisher for whom it was just a 100-to-1 shot.
And did you go into this with someone on your side, with an agent, or were you doing this alone?
I did this all myself. But again, I didn't have any pressure. I kind of felt good about the manuscript, but that didn't override the overwhelming message, which is you're going to get a lot of rejections. It's going to take years. It's going to be a long process. So I wasn't in any desperate
state. So you're not in a hurry, but you've decided on Text. What do you do?
I decided I was going to learn as much about Text as I could. Generally in publishing houses, there's someone who does the public face business, who does talks. So I found out who that person was. That was just Googling. And I went to see him.
So you stalk the publisher that you want.
Well, I educated myself in
a nice way of putting
face-to-face manner, I suppose. This person at that time, this is 2006, he was a part-time editor and part-time publicist at Text, a very little-known person called Michael Williams.
Not so little-known
Who was
now.
Very young and just like, just as he is now, adorable. This was 12 years ago. Young and wonderful, wonderful person. And I went to see him speak here at RMIT. They had a series where lots of different publishers spoke. I saw him here. I saw him at Writers Victoria and at the Melbourne Writers Festival that year. That was a long time ago when it was at the Malt House. And I went to each of those, tried to pay as much attention as I possibly could so that I had a better understanding of what they were looking for, the things that they valued, what was going to be that kind of match.
And so you didn't just run up to him and thrust the printed manuscript into his hands. Michael, publish me. So when did you get the yes?
At the final one of these events, I did queue up at the end to shake his hand and say thank you. And yes, I have a manuscript. And he incredibly generously suggested that I email him when it was done. And I did that. And he said, email it to me. No, post it to me. And I did that. And I mean, it's funny looking back, but you have a sense of urgency that someone is prepared to read it. So he said, send it to me. And I had expected him to say, send me the first three chapters and a synopsis. So I had worked extraordinarily hard on these first three chapters.
They were beautiful.
And then he said, no, the whole thing. And so I literally sat up all night that night, just double checking, proofreading, copy editing, going through it all over and over and over again. Of course, one day did not matter. I could have done that the next day. It was a ridiculous concept, but I just had
You've got to do it.
Yeah, I felt this door, you know, that would not be open forever. So I mailed it the next day.
And how long did you have to wait?
Well, this is the part of the story where people then hate me. It was probably that, again, this it speaks so much how vivid this is in my mind. I sent it off on the Tuesday of the 1 week. I didn't hear anything. And then the following week, the Friday, he rang me something like 3:30 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And he said, yeah, when I went to lunch today, I thought, oh, I'll knock off one of these manuscripts on my desk by reading it over lunch. And then it's out of my hair. And unfortunately, it was yours. I lost track of time. I'm only just back at my desk now.
Oh, my goodness. It's a dream.
It's a dream. He said, I'm taking a copy for the marketing director and the publicity people and the publisher so they can read it over the weekend. And then I wanted time to stop. I felt it was downhill from here. And all weekend, I'm like, just stop. I don't want to hear anything else because there is no way.
It's going to get better than this. That's really interesting to have that moment and think that it's not going to get better than that. Because I remember people telling me it won't get better than this. But of course, you dream that it's going to get better than that moment. But that moment obviously is still just imprinted on your brain.
It's still imprinted. I can recall going for breakfast on that Saturday morning and just wishing time would stop. Because being under consideration at the same publisher who had Kate Gwenville and MJ Hyland, and I just had no other wishes, really.
What were your expectations about what was going to happen next, about what the publishing process would be like?
I thought it would take a lot longer. I was extremely lucky. I got that call on the Friday, and on the Monday night, the publisher rang me and made me an offer. So it was really just the weekend.
And did you do all that bit by yourself?
All by myself. Once I had the contract, I sent it into the ASA, to their contract advisory service.
Wonderful service.
Yes. So they don't negotiate for you. They're not agents, but they will give you a report on the contract. And I'm a dotting I, crossing T person, as you've probably gathered. And my dear publisher, who was so incredibly patient, went through the contract with me. I had a lot of questions. And I was like, what does this mean? What does this mean? Because they're, you know, Kate, they're extraordinary documents for someone without a legal background. It's like enormous. 12 pages. Six-point type. What happens if...
Jargon.
Yeah, what happens if the warehouse is hit by an asteroid, just about? It's incredibly complex.
And you don't
complex.
Know any of that world.
That's
yet,
right.
Your first
That's
time.
Right. And I really forced myself to read every clause and ask my publisher to explain it to me. And he was unbelievably patient and, made it
Okay, so ASA is someone who's helping you out.
Yeah.
I've seen you write in a recent article for Victorian Writer that many writers talk about the actual publishing of the book being anticlimactic.
That's
in
right.
The end.
That's right.
Was that the experience for you?
I think it was because I had no, again, it wasn't like I was aiming for this goal that I'd always had. So to me, I was dealing with each step at a time and everything was so new to me. This is a long time ago and I didn't know, no one else, Chris Womersley had been published. I met him in the RMIT course and he has since, at that time and since, quite quickly became a very good friend of mine. He had been published by Scribe and that was a really exciting process. But other than him, I had nobody else I knew had ever been published. So it was all kind of new. So I was just kind of dealing with each step at a time and you know absolutely nothing. And each step is a revelation, like it's a whole new thing you've got to get your head around.
What was it like the first time you held your proof or a copy of your book in your hand?
It was just like another thing on the road.
Okay.
The moment for me was that phone call on that Friday afternoon that meant I am being seriously considered by people I respect. And to me, that was really the moment. And that was the most important moment for me out of all the moments since.
That came after.
Yeah.
What were some of the obstacles? What were some of the challenges?
The challenge in that first period, editing takes a lot of effort. The odds are for your first book, your contract and your advance is very small. There is no, you have a burning desire to quit everything else so you can devote yourself entirely to it. That's a bad idea because the odds are, again, not always, but the odds are it's not going to be a full-time job once the novel comes out. And it probably won't be a full-time job for quite a number of novels after that. So you have this deep desire not to do anything else, and anything else is a waste of your time. But the practical matter is you're going to need the money. So it's that balance between putting yourself under time pressure or putting yourself under financial pressure. To me, of those two, the better option is to put yourself under time pressure. So I was still kind of trying to earn a living while doing the edits, while getting my head around this entire new industry that I had just found myself in. Because it's different from the art part. It's an industry and you become part of that industry.
It is. And how did you work out how much you put into the art part and how much you put into that I am now a business, I am part of the industry?
This is the difficult thing. Wherever you draw that line, it's never going to feel right. It's taken me a long time to realise I'm better personally, and this is not going to be for everybody, but if I devote a lot more time to the art and a lot less to the business. So I have got myself an agent now, but that is only in the last 6 months.
Okay.
So I did four books without an agent. And that meant reading every contract, including my international contracts, of which at one point I had 16.
Wow.
Reading every commission statement that came in, pages and pages, understanding what each percentage was for, trying to get my head around withholding tax.
That's a huge amount.
Yeah. There's a rolling averages you can use when you're a creative professional when you do your tax. There's a lot to it. And I'm delighted to know all that. I'm not resentful of the time I put into it, but I needed to get up to speed on it. I need to understand it, but I don't need to live there. Probably that's the best way to put it. And that's what suits me best.
I know one of the things that you did for the business, and I think this was for Our Tiny Useless Hearts, because I've read the article so many times, was that you went and did a photo shoot.
I did.
And I remember reading that you found it quite ludicrous being in that position. Now, Catherine and I have just done a photo shoot.
Have you?
Which was both thrilling and excruciating.
Yes.
But I wanted to ask you about building that public yeah. image, that author image, Toni yeah. Jordan, compared to the private Toni Jordan who doesn't like going out much and wants to sit in her pajamas and do yeah. her work. How do you manage those two different aspects?
I have to force myself out of the house. And that's become more of a problem the more I do this work. So at the beginning, you know, when you have to go to work every day or go to school every day, whatever you're doing every day, the idea of not leaving the house is really, it was an ideal for me. Now that every day I don't have to leave the house, I find that for me, it becomes a problem because I could seriously become one of these agoraphobic people. And sometimes I think I'm really on the verge of that. This is not going to be a problem for everybody. I think this is just people who are, you know, me and people who are like me. I read a lot. I read still like two novels a week.
That's magic.
And I have no other hobbies or interests. I don't go anywhere. I barely watch television.
I think all the better for us.
Well, it's, it's a very,
obviously
my
life informs your work.
Yeah, very much. I have a very internal life, which makes me happy. So I have a rule now that I try and get out twice a week at the minimum. And if I can't, I mean, Thank you for inviting me out, Kate. I can tick one day on my week. But if I haven't got any two things planned for the week, I will text somebody for coffee or for lunch. And I don't always like it. And in fact, mostly I hate it. So if I'm supposed to be somewhere at 10:30, at a quarter to 10, I'm thinking, why did I say yes to this? Oh,
my
God.
Which is so striking, Tony, because I'm sure many people would find this unusual that you reveal this because of the work you do at festivals. You're so often hosting other writers in conversation. You've built as part of your career that kind of work as well.
I have.
And so you've done that out of necessity in building that career.
It's a necessity, but not for the career. It's a necessity for my mental health. Because if I don't say yes, if I start saying no, it's a very steep and slippery slope to 20 cats and, you know, the trauma cleaner having to come and do my house.
Yeah, okay.
Like I'm this far from it.
I see where this is leading.
And Tony, the work I find easy. It's delightful to talk to you. I enjoy teaching. I love mentoring writers. I love doing events, hosting events at the Wheeler Centre and getting to know other people better because it's an extension of the work and I always love the work. It's not the things that I dislike. It's just the physically leaving the house that I dislike. Once I'm out, I'm fine.
And so that is what your full-time writing-associated career, I suppose, has become, the writing and that associated teaching work. Are the rest of us on a fool's errand thinking that we can make a career out of it? You mentioned that at the start. It's not a great career.
I am not a remarkable person by any means, and I have made a career out of it. So I fail to see why someone else can't. There is no glowing halo in my on my head. I am a very late starter to this and I have no gifts that would mean that it would be different for me than for somebody else. I've had good years when I've made enough money from the writing. I've been doing this now, remember. I've signed my first contract in 2006. Yep. I've had good years where I don't have to do anything else. I've made enough money from writing fiction. I've had years where I make almost nothing from writing fiction and all of the income comes from speaking and teaching and events. And, you know, normally it's something like 50-50.
Okay.
But I keep, as I said, those events are important for me for other reasons.
To be in that community too. Tony, Catherine's obviously about to start on this.
Ooh, Catherine!
Journey out into that first book land. What advice could you give or what advice do you wish you had been given that first time around when you were about to embark on it all?
The most important thing to me to remember is that it's about the work. Kate Kennedy said this to me when I was first published. It's about the work. You can't make somebody love it. You can't go around the country and push it into people's hands and rip their headphones off their ears and make them read it. What you can control is your relationship with the work when you're sitting in front of it, when it's still yours. If you can't enjoy that as that being the key to this whole thing, if you're doing it as a means to an end, it's going to be a very hard road. That's what Kate Kennedy said to me, and that's the advice that I'm passing on to you, Catherine. It's about the work.
And have you been able to keep that with you the entire time through your...
I think I lost it a bit for my second novel because you're so thrown by the publication process that you forget entirely your head is still spinning while you're trying to work on something else. I think a lot of people experience this, that the second is the most difficult.
I'm so glad to hear you say that.
Yes, the second is by far the most difficult because you're at once outside of yourself and inside of yourself. You wrote the first book being inside of yourself, having that quiet space to have this story and these people bloom. And then once it's published and it becomes other people's work, it's no longer your work. The ownership of that work transfers over to other people. And then you are caught in this position of at the same time being inside yourself and at the same time looking at yourself through other people's eyes, being outside yourself. And this kind of split personality effect where you read the review and you, for that moment, enter the headspace of someone who is outside of you looking back at your work is extremely disconcerting. And I think it takes a while to regain your equilibrium after that.
But you clearly do regain your equilibrium.
I really feel that I did.
So beautifully shown us. Tony, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks,
and
Kate,
for sharing your wisdom with us.
It's been a joy. Thanks.
So, Tony, I'm going to ask you our first time quick five questions, which you can, of course, pass on because we know we're getting nitty gritty with people here. So for your first time, agented or unagented?
Unagented.
Advance or no advance?
Advance, but small.
Overseas territories or just Australia and New Zealand?
Overseas territories.
How many?
I feel like I want to say 16.
16!
But I'd have to check.
That's all right. 16 is wonderful. Festival invites or no festival invites?
Festival invites.
What did you do?
I did Perth, Sydney, Melbourne. Yeah, I think that's,
wow,
that's what I did.
Brilliant. And for your first book, do you know how many copies sold?
You know, I don't know. And I deliberately don't know because I don't want to know.
You don't want to know. Never make me look at this figure again.
Yeah, I never. I don't. I just, that's not somewhere that I want my brain to go.
Okay, that's Tony Jordan's quick five. Tony, another question for you. Do you have a debut fiction recommendation for us? Someone's first book that you love or remember or could recommend?
Well, I have to go with the classic here, which is Zadie Smith's White Teeth, which I think is, you know, actually I'm hesitant to recommend it to emerging writers who are working on their debut novel for fear that they read it and just quit.
Just crawl into a hole and say, I will never, ever be this good.
That's right. But that to me is just, it's mind-blowing debut fiction.
Brilliant. Thank you, Tony.
We'd love to hear from you. Let us know about your first time or any questions you'd like us to answer. We're on Twitter and Instagram at The First Time Pod. Thanks.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast, a podcast about the first time you publish a book. We recorded this episode at RMIT University on the traditional land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. This podcast is produced by Phoebe Ady and Harry Morris. The First Time Podcast is created with the support of Writers Victoria, ACT Writers Centre and RMIT School of Media and Communication.